Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as a quick reminder to those that are joining us live, if you are so inclined, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, go ahead and jump in the chat room. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. That's also a good place where if you have some questions you wanted to have us direct to our guests, it doesn't look like we're quite going there, that would be the place to do it. And also it's a place where, actually not on the chat room, but in case you run into some issues and you got to run off halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, you can always catch the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. So let's get on with the show. And today we're going to focus on, if anybody's been to sea and you've needed to get from point A to point B, or you needed to eat, or you needed to have somebody else follow up behind you, you know, the one linchpin you always have to keep an eye on is our friend, the Military Sealift Command. And we're going to have a guest on today that's just the right guy to help us dedicate a full hour to that discussion. He will be Sal Mercogliano. He is the Assistant Professor of History at Campbell University. He is a 1989 graduate of SUNY Maritime College, where he got a BS in Maritime Transportation. He's got a fair bit of time at sea. On both TAOs, TAHs, AGFF even, one of my favorites, and, of course, with TAOs as well. At ashore, he worked at the N3 shop over at the Afloat Prepositioning Force, working on the Marine Corps MPF vessels. And later, he kept with his focus on the land side of the equation, working on the Army program, including the construction and conversion of LMSRs. In 96, he transitioned over to his academic career, receiving his MA in Maritime History and Nautical Archaeology from ECU, East Carolina University, focused on the Merchant Marine during the Vietnam War, and he went on to the University of Alabama from there to get his PhD in Military and Naval History with his dissertation on entitled Sealift. He's done the academic roundabout, teaching over at Methodist University, East Carolina, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, also the U.S. Military Academy, prior to be an assistant professor of history with Campbell University, where he has hung his hat since 2010. Additionally, since 2008, he's been an adjunct professor over at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, where he's teaching a graduate-level course online on maritime industry policy, something I plan on tapping in during the course of the show. If you want to catch more of his thoughts, you can Google him up. He's been published over at Northern Mariner, Sea History, Naval History, and, of course, the U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings. The other Sal, welcome to Midrats. It's great to have you aboard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Hey, thought we'd just do a scene setter here because it's something that we have brought up in previous shows about a lot of very important programs that unfortunately don't seem to break above the background noise with a lot of the top-level publications. I like to call them the unsexy but important. And especially in the last year when people look at the maritime side of the national security equation and the budgetary stresses we've had, you know, people want to talk about carriers. People want to talk about, you know, ballistic submarines in the 2020s, how we're going to be able to afford that, LCS, other items. But just as important as those items, especially when we look towards the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, which is very heavy on logistical support, the Merchant Marine is absolutely as critically important as that. Where do we stand in that conversation, and where is our Merchant Marine here in 2014?
Well, as you were alluding to, the Merchant Marine is an interesting bear to look at. One of the things I always like to kind of preface my conversations when I talk about this is the merchant marine represents the commercial aspects of a nation. In many ways, if you go back to Alfred Thayer Mahan and his initial, you know, definition of sea power was always viewed as a two-armed beast. There was the military arm and the commercial arm. And I think in many ways, a lot of topics that you've been hitting on recently talk about the fact that our merchant marine has not been well acknowledged. Right now, in terms of our commercial fleet, we're 22nd in the world in terms of U.S. flagged vessels out there, eclipsed by such, you know, powerhouses as Panama, Liberia, Malta, Isle of Man, Marshall Islands. While that is a pretty bad number there, 22, in truth, you look at ownership, the United States is the fifth largest owner of merchant ships in the world, so we still have a fairly large, good maritime infrastructure. Where you see problems, and particularly when it comes to looking at the Navy, you look at the current battle force numbers out there. If you look at a force of roughly around 300 vessels that the Navy identifies in the battle force, one out of five of them currently reside within what is known as Military Sealift Command, the kind of the military arm of the Merchant Marine that the Navy operates and has been kind of overseeing since 1949, when MSTS, the precursor to Military Sea Transportation Service, was created. So you're talking about one out of five, 20% of U.S. naval vessels are crewed, operated, or have some sort of civilian component on board, a hybrid crew. And that's a pretty substantial number when you start thinking about it. And so it's very easy today. There's a lot of debate goes on. If you read a lot of publications, Journal of Commerce, Maritime Executive, all the kind of trade publications that are out there on the commercial side, you'll read debates about Jones Act, whether or not we need to maintain a U.S. merchant marine. And commercially speaking, you can make an argument, and many people have made an argument, that we no longer need a commercial merchant marine because foreign flag can get our goods from point A to point B. We can get the goods from China or the Far East to the United States. However, if you start looking at sea power and the projection of military forces and the support of those military forces, whether they be the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, then having a merchant marine is an essential part of that. And if you're going to have a first-class Navy in many ways, you need to have a merchant marine that supports it to be able to kind of provide the transportation and the logistics to support it. And this is one of the things I've focused in my studies, is really looking at that relationship and how the Navy and, not just the Navy, I should say, but the Department of Defense and the commercial sector has existed over time. I take my study back all the way to the American Revolution and forward, but in truth, the place I really identify as the real good starting point is the Spanish-American War of 1898. That's really where you see the kind of bifurcation of the commercial merchant marine and the military, and it begins to kind of increase in scope and scale as you go forward from there. And so it's an interesting topic because of this difference. A lot of people, even within the Navy itself, don't quite understand what an organization like Military Sealift Command is or even what the Merchant Marine does. The Merchant Marine is not an entity. It doesn't exist. There's no, you know, leader of the U.S. Merchant Marine. It's not even a true coherent organization. It's actually a composite of shipyards, individual shippers, schools, educations, unions, trade schools, and yet it's the only occupation in the entire country that has its own unique federal academy that is designed to support it, which came out of the Second World War at King's Point. So I think this study is a very interesting one to kind of look at and understand how the Merchant Marine works and how it directly supports the Department of Defense. And the budget side is of course, interesting because being low man on the totem pole, and the way you can tell the Merchant Marine is always the low man on the totem pole, is, you know, look at any publication, any kind of almanac. If you go to the Freeman's Book or Sea Power's almanac of it, you know, MSC will be in the back. And unfortunately, that tends to be where it is sometimes in the budget forecast. Recent talks have been released about maybe phasing out two of the AOEs of the four, cutting back on two of the four fleet tugs, two of the four salvage vessels. And these are key vessels. These are obviously critically important. The AOEs in particularly provide you one-stop shopping for the carrier battle groups, and they're the only platforms we have that have the speed and capability to actually keep up with a carrier battle group on a deployment. While AKEs and AOs are great, they do lack the speed and the legs in some cases to be able to stay up with a battle group.
When we talk about the Merchant Marine, one of the questions a lot of people have is, who are the people who are in our Merchant Marine? How do they get where they are? Are there licensing requirements, and who licenses them so that they can drive these commercial ships around the ocean or whatever other jobs they have out there at sea? Can you kind of discuss that background a little bit?
Sure, and you know, in answering a question like that, it's kind of like you know, who makes up the Navy, and you know, it's not one mold fits the entire pattern. What makes the Merchant Marine unique, and I get that asked a lot. You know, I always talk about my career in the Merchant Marine, and people will look at you with that face and say, "Oh yeah, that's great," and then they'll take a moment and sit there and say, "What exactly is that?" And you know, the Merchant Marine represents, again, all the commercial assets of a nation, whether it be a tugboat, an ocean-going tanker, a freighter. It differs, and this is something that we see that plays a role in how an organization like Military Sealift Command works, and particularly in a previous broadcast you all did with the CEO of the USS Ponce. Merchant mariners have to go out and kind of get the training on their own. And so to become a merchant mariner, to become a licensed member of the Merchant Marine, what that entails is, number one, taking a test with the U.S. Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is the regulatory body that regulates the Merchant Marine. There are two tracks, main tracks in the Merchant Marine. There's the deck side and the engine side. Deck sides are the deck officers. Engine side are those down in the engine room, obviously. And to do this, you can either sign on board a ship through a union hall or directly with companies, earn your sea time, and then progress up the chain through a series of steps. For the deck side, it's ordinary seamen to able-bodied seamen. For the engine side, it's wiper to a junior engineer. But on a lot of merchant mariners now, because there's not as many job billets out there, will go the track of going to either the Federal Academy at Kings Point or one of the six of the state schools, four-year institutions where they'll get their undergraduate degrees, but also be able to sit and take a license and come out as third assistant engineers or third mates. And that allows you to have the training, the background ready to go. So, for example, when I graduated from SUNY Maritime with a third mate's license, I was able to get a job with MSC immediately. At the time, the Atlantic office was headquartered in New Jersey over at Hoboken. Spent a few weeks getting some certificates and required training, and within a very short period of time, I can go out on my first ship and be able to stand a deck watch. And one of the things that they have is you learn a lot of the background in trade. You're coming in as kind of a trained, certified personnel. So you don't have, in the case of a shipping company or a Military Sealift Command, having to provide a lot of back training to get these people up and running. And that's one of the reasons why you hear a lot of talk about the difference between mariners and sailors. And it really has a lot to do with just the background and experience. Where they're coming from and how they develop that. So they provide that kind of a knowledge base for you. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, in the 1970s, you saw the transition of many of the Navy auxiliaries over from U.S. Navy crews to smaller mariner crews, starting with USNS Tuluga in 1972, and then increasing until you get to the point in 2010 when Frank Cable, subtender, becomes the very last auxiliary in the Navy that has a merchant mariner crew on board. A hybrid crew is the very last one that gets on board there.
It's funny, you anticipated exactly one of my questions I was going to ask later on in the show, but I'll go ahead and pull it out now. It started in the 70s, like you said, but especially in our adult life, you and I are roughly the same age, we've seen a lot of ships go from USN to USNS, and you described some of the ships that have, you know, even some of the tugs used to be USN type ships, good lieutenant commands. Kind of pull the thread on that a little bit for the listeners that may not be familiar with that history. Why was that move done? And in a macro sense for the Navy and its appreciation of auxiliaries and their role, was that really a good move to make? And knowing what we know now, do you think it would still be the right decision to make?
Oh, I think to look at that move and understand how the Navy has transitioned over this, I'm very interested in the fact that the hybrid crews that we're talking about a lot now, you know, Ponce was a great example of that, having a civilian master on board serving under a Navy captain. You know, for a historian like me, that goes back to the age of sail when a Navy captain would have a civilian master on board to pilot the ship for him. And in many ways, we're almost starting to come full circle on this evolution. I'll take you back a little bit here and talk about this progression, because I think it's interesting to lay out to understand how we got to where we are today. If you go back to 1949, when MSTS, the Military Sea Transportation Service, is created, up until that period of time, if you look at the previous events, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, we pretty much ad hoc'd our logistics. We had organizations that were created out of those conflicts. For example, coming out of the Spanish-American War, immediately after, the Army creates the Army Transport Service, the Navy creates the U.S. Collier Service. World War I, such a large operation, there's an interesting element here. We're just finishing the bicentennial of the War of 1812, and the Navy has loved talking about the bicentennial of the War of 1812. We're now getting ready to celebrate the centennial of World War I. I don't think you'll see a big celebration on the centennial of World War I, because the U.S. Navy's role in World War I is a lot different than it is in World War II. It plays a major role in convoying. It deploys a squadron of battleships up the Scapa Flow. But really the big thing it does is transport over the American Expeditionary Force, 2 million troops. And that wasn't a mission that the Navy really grasped onto. It wasn't a very sexy mission in many ways. You don't get to become an admiral commanding a troop transport, but it's extremely vital to understand that that projection of military power was those troop transports in World War I, just like a projection of power today is an F-18 catapulting off an aircraft carrier, or a Tomahawk shooting off a submarine. World War II is even a more difficult issue because it's not just moving troops across the Atlantic. It's a war on multiple fronts, and you're dealing with multiple threats. And to do that, the military had to really come up with a new agency, and you actually have an incident very early in World War II where the Navy and the Army were competing against each other, trying to procure ships. They had a very famous operation to supply an island in the Pacific, Bora Bora, and set up a fueling station there. That operation goes really bad, and the decision is made by FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to create a civilian agency that would oversee the sea lift aspect, what was known as the War Shipping Administration. At the end of World War II, the military realizes, number one, the scenario has changed here. We're now a global power. We're dealing with nuclear weapons. We're dealing with a potential foe in the Soviet Union. We can't wait to kind of ad hoc this together. So in 1949, the Department of Defense creates what is the Military Sea Transportation Service. It's not something the Navy embraces initially. It's actually, they don't want it. It's kind of a consolation prize given to the Navy because this is the period of the revolt of admirals. You have the Army trying to grab the Marine Corps. You have the Air Force trying to grab naval aviation. And kind of as a bone here, they're going to toss all the sea lift assets over to the Navy. That's not a great gift for the Navy. They really don't like it. However, it does give the Navy the opportunity to for once and for all, really create an organization with worldwide capabilities, a standing organization that has the ability to support troops. And what's interesting is you have the stand-up on October 1st, 1949, and almost immediately MSTS comes under fire from both the military and the civilian side. The civilian merchant marine doesn't like it. The shipping companies don't like it. They feel like you're creating a government merchant marine and they're going to be shut out of business. The Navy isn't crazy about the organization. They don't like it. The Army doesn't like losing their ships. But fortunately for the organization, an event takes place that proves its capability, and that is the Korean War in June of 1950. And so, very quickly, MSTS demonstrates its capability. Its very existence is able to shift over forces from Japan into Korea, and then eventually deploy forces across the Pacific. and stem the tide with the Pusan perimeter, later on the landing at Incheon and Wonsan, and the evacuation at Hungnam. And almost immediately, the organization begins to adapt and grow. And I think that's one of the most unique concepts of military seal of command. We're talking a lot today in new capabilities, the joint high-speed vessel, the mobile landing platform vessel, and it's like, wow, you know, MSC is really adapting extremely well. That's been a hallmark of this organization from the very beginning. As early as 1958, for example, CNO Admiral Arleigh Burke wants MSTS oilers, or excuse me, tankers, point-to-point tankers, to have the capability to consolidate with Navy oilers, provide station tankers, something that was done during World War II but had been lost. The organization adopts a special missions program, starts operating vessels that are unique missions for it. For example, they create a trio of vessels that are going to go out and survey the ocean bottoms and the ocean currents. And on board these three vessels, they'll deploy a system called SINS, inertial navigation system that will be used to basically be mounted into the Boomer submarine. So you have these three vessels, what were known as the triplets. They would go out, run tracks, and basically those were the tracks the Boomers would eventually follow out of Holy Lock, Rota, and Guam. And so special missions capabilities come in. You get intel ships, the MISAR, which is going to be instrumental in finding lost objects on the bottom of the ocean, surveillance vessels. And very quickly, the platforms begin to evolve and grow. Special missions also gets range instrumentation ships to monitor rocket launches. And so that when you get to Vietnam in the 1970s, it's not an unusual aspect to see that next progression take place where you're going to start shifting auxiliary vessels from the combat fleet over to MSC. So, no, I think if you look at the history of it, the progression is a very natural progression, and I hope that answers the question.
I think it answers the question. How is it that that the shift, having served on an ammo ship, USS ammo ship when I was a young officer, how is it that the Merchant Marine can, or our MSC people can, CIVMARS can operate that ship for less cost, lower cost than having the regular Navy sailors on there?
Well, one of the things you look at is as we alluded to before, is crew size. If you look at everything from a Kilauea class AE to a Mars class AFS to the supply class AOEs, one of the things you tend to see is a lower operating cost, or excuse me, lower personnel numbers. That's always been one of the advantages there, and one of the reasons is you lose some aspects of it. They are not the same exact things. I'm always hesitant to use the apple and oranges comparison because I don't think that's quite true. I think it's a difference of different types of apples. You know, you lose when you transfer over, for example, Kilauea, which was the lead class of AEs. She was transferred over in 1980, and she was the only AE for a long time until the 1990s when the rest came over. And one of the issues there was also a security issue back when we still had nuclear weapons on vessels. It was very you had to be very particular about crews. They had to have proper security clearances. And so it was just hard to have a manpower pool that was suitable for that. However, today, when you look at the AKEs, the Lewis and Clark class AKEs, one of the things that you have is kind of almost an economy of scale. You know, a Lewis Clark AKE combines together a Mars or Sirius class AFS and a Kilauea class AE. It takes about 60% of each of those vessels' capabilities and put them all on board one platform. So you get an economy of scale. AKEs are a classic economy of scale vessel. Bigger, just look at a side-by-side comparison, and you'll get that image. You have a lot of technological innovations on there. When you look at UNREP rigs, I remember if you looked at UNREP rigs on a Cimarron-class AO compared to a Henry J. Kaiser-class TAO, one of the things you'll see is a lot of automation, a lot lower crew personnel that you need on board. And again, the other aspect you have, too, is you get out of a lot of costs that you don't have. CIVMARS, civilian mariners, which are, to give you the good definition here, a civilian mariner is someone who works for Military Sealift Command and is employed directly by the federal government. MSC actually employs two types of merchant mariners. There are the CIVMARS, directly employed by the federal government, and then there are contract CIVMARS that are either through the unions or operating companies. When we look at the gray hulls, the AOs, the AKEs, the AOEs, they have CIVMARS on board. So these are people who are employed directly by the U.S. government. They're crewed and staffed out of the MSC's office in Norfolk and then dispatched out to vessels and do roughly about a four-month tour on board a vessel. They operate under government guidelines, so they're civil service employees. They operate under the same civil service rules. There are some problems with that, I will tell you. There was a recent story out about the crews on the LCSs, the very small crews on the LCSs becoming overworked and tired. That's a problem on CIVMAR vessels, I will tell you. It used to be six-month deployments on CIVMAR vessels. Now it's down to four-month deployments. The problem is leave time. Leave has always been an issue on CIVMAR vessels. When you're a CIVMAR sailing on a ship, you work every day, 7 days a week, 8 hours a day. And not to belittle my Navy brethren out there, the difference is for CIVMAR only works on a ship. That's his bread and butter. He's going to work on a ship. And if he works for 4 months, he may have 2-3 weeks of leave built up when he gets off. And that's not a lot of time in between transitioning between ships. And so you have a pretty high attrition rate in right now going on with CIVMARs. And one of the things you're starting to see a lot in Military Sealift Command is a lot of ex-military rolling in to CIVMAR billets. It used to be, back when I sailed, the CIVMARs were not, the ex-military were pretty rare at the time. Now it's becoming a much more a common idea to see them on there. But to get back to your issue about the ship costs, I would always argue that it's really not so much the cost that you save. In some ways, the costs aren't really too different, but the one big difference you have is the op tempo. You can keep a CIVMAR vessel at sea for a lot longer period of time than you can a Navy vessel, because you don't have to worry about the purse tempo issues. The article out not too long ago in Navy Times, which talked about how long different type vessels were out, showcased different types of USN crewed vessels. They didn't look at MSC vessels, and I did a quick little examination of that. And real quick, you were looking at MSC vessels staying at sea for a much longer period of time because, again, they don't have to be burdened by the issue of home ports and crew rotations. They can operate, and there's almost a continually changing out body of crews on there coming out of the office in Norfolk. So they can maintain a pretty high state of readiness and deployment out there. And it's one of the good features of them that allow the Navy to use them the way they can and being forward deployed as they are.
A couple things. I actually had one question I'm going to split in two. I'll ask the other one later. But, you know, you're talking about our merchant sailors, CIVMARs, and when you look at the transition from peace to war, there's a couple things historically that we've always seen. Some of the planning assumptions, it just, you know, usually just goes straight out the door, is units usually find themselves a lot closer to combat than they expected to be in peace. Units that thought they were going to be far away from the action all of a sudden become the center of the action. The British experience with the Atlantic Conveyor is, you know, just one item in recent history that comes to mind. Another thing is that eventually, because of that, everything gets upgunned for point defense, which means even ships that were not previously armed become armed. Ships that were lightly armed become medium armed. You look at some of the ships towards the end of the Second World War are really, again, going back to the Falkland Islands, up to the point of having crew members on the side with personal arms shooting the jets. You got to do what you got to do. And are there some issues with CIVMARs and the Military Sealift Command ships from a personal policy issue about them being asked to go into harm's way? And, you know, one of the newer items looking at the MLP, the mobile landing platforms, that, you know, designed to come in after most things are done. But beaches that were cold can become hot really quickly. Are there some legal issues or personnel policy issues that may need to be looked at if we're going to have our SIVMARs and WAR get a little more upfront and personal than they may think?
This has always been the kind of the dicey issue, I will tell you. One of the reasons why you see a big split in some versions of the Navy and Merchant Mariners, and this goes back actually to World War II again. If you look at the Second World War, there was a perception coming out of the Second World War that the Merchant Mariners that sailed were not basically loyal to their ships, that they had a different view. And that actually comes out of believe it or not, a perception that it comes out of the Navy history of the Second World War. Samuel Eliot Morison writes a very famous 15-volume series about the U.S. Navy in World War II. And I love Morison. I love everything he wrote. I grew up reading it and everything. But when you do a study of it and you go back through it, Morison has a very kind of slanted view of the Merchant Marine that kind of gets kind of permeated through a lot of the concepts and literature that separates them. I'll read you a quick passage he wrote, and this is in one of his volumes on the history of the United States Naval Operations World War II, specifically his Battle of the Atlantic One. Relations between the Navy and the Merchant Marine have always been somewhat delicate. In the Merchant Marine, there is a sturdy independence which in time of war becomes a fault. Any ship in which a blue jacket serves on is his ship, his country's ship to be defended with his life if need be. But to the Union-indoctrinated merchant seaman, the ship is the ownership, his class's enemies to whom he owes nothing and from which he is morally entitled to squeeze all he can. Now, Morison obviously does not like Union merchant mariners, which is fine. I understand that entirely. There's a lot of issues associated with that. But when you get back to the question you were asking about that kind of the issue of merchant mariners in war, you know, during World War II, the Merchant Marine becomes the only civilian occupation that is literally on the front lines during the conflict. I mean, I live here in North Carolina, not too far from the Outer Banks, and that was seen of some of the most horrific attacks on the U.S. Merchant Marine in World War II. The 6 months after Pearl Harbor is a pretty grisly time along the east coast of the United States. About 8,000 merchant mariners die in World War II. They don't find themselves with a lot of protection as military personnel did. Matter of fact, merchant mariners were not given veterans benefits until 1988 for those who served in World War II. And again, it's a comparison between the Navy and the Merchant Marine that's a little bit different. I disagree with Morison in his perception there. I don't think he's correct on that. But even in a conflict as fast forward to Vietnam, I did a study on the Merchant Marine in the Vietnam War that for the Navy Historical Foundation and the Navy Heritage and History Command. And in that study, we looked at the Merchant Marine and the role Sealift played in Vietnam. And to the best of my accounting, I figured out 44 merchant mariners died, you know, supporting the Sealift effort during roughly 1965 to 1975. Again, merchant mariners are not military. They don't join the military, and so therefore they're not always entitled to the same benefits and protection. However, they did die, you know, in many cases running the rungsat through attacks on the ships, mining of vessels, sapper attacks on the ships. As recently as the Somalia operation in 1992, 93, and even up to 1994, you had rocket attacks on merchant vessels in the harbor at Mogadishu. And you know, you have the potential for targeting of merchant ships today. And so the issue becomes an extremely dicey one. Under law, when you arm merchant vessels, just straight merchant vessels, that's a big problem. You go back to the Captain Phillips and the Maersk Alabama. The reason that ship does not have armed guards on board is because it cannot pull into most ports if it carries weapons on board. However, most MSC ships are government-owned under U.S. rules, and so they operate under a different entity. And I will tell you right now, MSC has done a study on this. They've did pretty extensive ruling on this to determine what the issues are and what's associated with it. And basically what they've come up with is this idea that as long as it's defensive in nature, then they're covered. In other words, as long as you're not putting an MLRS battery or Tomahawk cruise missiles, something offensive on a MSC vessel, they can get away with defensive arming. Matter of fact, if you go back and look at the design of the Henry J. Kaiser oilers, they were fitted with the mounts to hold two fouling Sea Whizzes on board, along with chaff dispensers. They were never mounted, but they have that capability to do it. In the British Navy, in the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, which is kind of the MSC version they have, one of the ways they get around that is RFA vessels do have weapon mounted on them, 20 millimeters and 7.62 millimeters. However, they have gun crews, RN gun crews, that are on board. This way the civilians aren't touching the weapons. This way it's the RN, the Royal Navy, that's firing, not the U.S. I will tell you, I think this is a very dicey issue. I think if there's an issue that's looming on the horizon that has a little bit of a potential to kind of come back here, it is the idea of civilian manned vessels under attack or under arms, which could be an issue. How exactly does that play out? If you look at something like the Ponce, for example, which has a Navy captain who oversees all aspects of the vessel, that vessel gets involved in something. It has a civilian crew on board that's in charge of the deck and engine department. How do those civilian crew fall under the rules and regulations? If that ship is attacked, do they have the same status as a U.S. Navy U.S. Navy sailor on board? And I think this is one of those issues we're seeing up. And it's getting a little bit even more dicey when you start looking at where MSC is going with the chartering of new platforms, the motor vessel Craigside, which is going to be a car ferry, for a special weapons platform, or the use of some of the other vessels. If you start looking at the MLPs coming out, potential use of joint high-speed vessels, I think this is an issue that needs a lot of clarification of how you're going to deal with this. Like I said, the issue has not been dealt with the U.S. merchant mariners who sailed in World War II. So I don't think you can actually say there's a clear answer to this question as of right now for that status.
Well, during World War II, we put some of the stuff you wrote to talk about the Naval Armed Guards and the controversy that caused with some of the merchant crews in World War II. And long before that, our merchant ships, in fact, if you go back in the history of our Navy, many of them became part of our Navy, and our merchant ships were armed as a matter of course. I mean, it was expected that a merchant ship in commerce would defend itself against pirates and other ships. I'm kind of surprised at the modern rule, and I don't know where it changed. I haven't done my legal homework on this, but I'm kind of surprised there's that much controversy about it. But in speaking along those lines, I mean, I have a poster on my wall from my days in the Naval Control of Shipping world, and it shows the tanker Bridgeton leading its escort vessels through the Gulf of the Persian Gulf as part of the minesweeping effort. I think the Bridgeton may have been the biggest, most expensive minesweeper we had in a while, just showing that the merchants have been involved in armed conflicts in many different ways.
No, and I think one of the things I like to talk about a lot is one of the things is we do sealift so well that sometimes we forget that it's such an integral part of it. If you look at a study, like I said, with Vietnam, we're able to ship a ton of cargo 7,000 miles from San Francisco to the docks in Saigon easier than it is to walk a ton of cargo down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we do that consistently in operation after operation and after operation. We're really good at it. You can't pull off Westmoreland's big unit operations in Vietnam if we can't surge and sea lift and sustain, a 7-division force in Vietnam when everyone told them you can't do it. You can't put 500,000 troops into Vietnam. And yet you build the ports, you build the infrastructure, you come up with new technology, which is, again, a hallmark, I would say, of sea lift. You look at the Vietnam War, containerization, Malcolm McLean from beautiful North Carolina, you know, is a trucker. He's not a shipper, but he comes up with that idea of containerization, and now all of a sudden you have a paradigm that shifts not just the commercial world as we know it today, but it shifts the military world, and all of a sudden now you can alleviate a 100-ship backlog that's at the docks in Saigon, and with, you know, 11 ships be able to sustain 10% of all the cargo going into Vietnam. That's what Sealift can provide you. That's what it can do. However, there are issues looming on the horizon that are not being addressed, I think, in many cases for our future, and I think it's a very important one. You know, we talked about Sealift in the very beginning and the state of the merchant marine. One of the programs that came out of the 1990s after the first Persian Gulf War was a program to examine, are our Sealift measures being met? And you had a couple of programs that came out of that, something called the Large Medium Speed Railroad Program that built 20 and converted 20 large medium speed railroads. You had something called the Maritime Security Program that was aimed to make sure that there was enough merchant ships in the U.S. commercial fleet to maintain the network of sustainment of the container flow and fuel flow across. But most importantly is that MSP provides not just the ships but also the crews, because one of the things that we rely on is a reserve fleet of vessels. Half those LMSRs and about 46 vessels are maintained in what's referred to as the Ready Reserve Force. Those ships are staffed minimally with about 8 to 9 crew members on board. They need about 30 to 40 to get underway, and they're going to pull those from the merchant marine. As I said before, you don't need a merchant marine, a U.S. merchant marine, if you're just getting your goods from China to the United States. But if you need a merchant marine to be able to haul your tanks, your cargo, your combat forces, then you need a merchant marine that you can call upon that can plus up those crews and do it. And you see that happening in the Navy now. The change is taking place. You talked about the Navy control shipping. You know, we lost the old Merchant Marine Reserve program, and now you have the Strategic Sealift Officer program. And that program has morphed. It's now designed to try to keep mariners' licenses current so that in case we need them, they can basically man up and take ships out of the Ready Reserve Force or the reduced operating status. But even then, the RRF is getting critically old. You're talking about a program that was started back in 1977. Some of the vessels in there are dated. Even the 8 fast sealift ships that we've put in there from MSC, they were built back in the early 1970s. And so there's a critical issue that's kind of looming on the horizon. Even the maritime prepositioning ships currently out in the fleet, the 5 AMC class MPS vessels, built in the early 80s. So you're getting ships that are going to be 40, 50 years old. And so it's an issue that needs to be looked upon. Plus, without a strong merchant marine, that deals with your infrastructure base back at home. One of the issues we talk about is shipyards and ship construction and why ship construction is so expensive to build new platforms. If you look back in the 1980s when we started the 600-ship Navy, one of the offsets of the 600-ship Navy is it really drove commercial shipping out of the United States, because shipyards would much rather have a contract for 30 Navy destroyers than a contract to build 4 or 5 commercial vessels. And while a container ship is not a destroyer, it's not a submarine, it's sure not an aircraft carrier, it still provides you a lot of that infrastructure base that you need. And while we're building some ships, they're being built in yards that really aren't associated with what you're going to build Navy ships in. And this is something the British learned. I mean, they took this lesson out of the Falklands, where they pulled their vessels out of trade, stuffed, slapped guns on them, sent them down to the Falklands, and did an absolutely phenomenal, phenomenal job. But the problem is when those ships came back home, the jobs they had, the runs they were operating on, had disappeared. They'd been taken over by other ships at cheaper and you know, less cost to the shippers, and so therefore, in many ways, if you look at the way the Royal Navy is going, the way the British Merchant Marine went is very similar to how the American Merchant Marine is going today, which is an issue that needs to be, you know, at the forefront, I think, of some of our discussions about what is our true kind of maritime policy going to be, not just a military maritime policy, but a civilian maritime policy.
I want to keep pulling on that thread because, you know, you have your dead weight tonnage capital ships, but you also have the intellectual capital that you just can't create overnight. You know, for a maritime nation, two oceans, it's no small matter because when you need it, you need it. And I know you made a comment earlier on about some people said, well, we can just let other nations carry our commerce, why worry about it? Well, history has a few lessons for people that want to study it about what happens to maritime nations who all of a sudden find themselves not being able to control their commerce. But when you look, and a lot of this is anecdotal, but, you know, we are the number one economy in the world, the number one navy in the world, a two-ocean mercantile republic. Yet it seems in many respects that the Scandinavian countries, you know, the Danes, especially the Norwegians, lesser spent the Swedes, population, you know, 5.5 million, they have a pretty significant presence in the global civilian maritime trade. What is it about the United States, even relative to Great Britain, which is a much smaller nation as well, that we seem to have become very comfortable with not even being able to compete at a level that you would think that the world's number one economy would be able to compete? Is it tort law? Is it culture? You know, what is it that's really holding us back from being a little more sustainable for the level of merchant that we should have for our size of a nation?
I think you have a couple of aspects right there that you kind of touched on, and I'll extrapolate a little bit on it. I think one of the things we've done is number one, we don't discuss the issue very well. For example, again, I'll talk about just the area I look at. You talk about Navy logistics. You talk about the role of that. It's not very good. I hate to say this to my brethren over at the Navy Historical Center, but Navy doesn't do very good history in some ways. It's very difficult to do it. The archives need a lot of work. This is the big study that came out not too long ago. And so I don't think we tell our story very well. We're great at telling stories of battles and aspects about that. But sometimes the stuff that really, you know, matters, that you know, again, you know, professionals, you know, amateur study tactics, professional study logistics, it's hard to make it sexy. It's hard to make it very interesting. It's hard to make people understand it. But we have also shifted. If you look at, you know, again, ports and infrastructure, go to New York City, you don't see a lot of cargo moving through New York City because the port doesn't handle it no more. It's been moved off. It's in Newark. It's in, you know, because the ships got bigger, the type of material handling has changed, and it is moved off. Most Americans are really, I hate to use the term ignorant, but are unaware of the scope and scale of how much cargo is moved. There was a study done in Great Britain, for example, which is an island nation, and they asked how much of your cargo comes from outside of Great Britain, and the numbers were dismally low that people were guessing. They had no idea that about 90% of everything gets shipped into their islands. And so I think there's an education aspect that's important here. And that's not just a military, it's also a civilian side that we need to talk about it. You know, in 2007, when the Navy released their cooperative strategy of sea power, they did it with the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, and they were very proud that they incorporated the Coast Guard in. My criticism is they didn't bring the commercial side in. They didn't bring the Maritime Administration side in to talk about that, you know, to understand how important it is that you have that commercial sea base to connect to. And again, people just are not aware. Again, it's you're not aware of something until all of a sudden it's not there, and then all of a sudden it becomes imminently apparent of how important it was. Plus, there's been changes, too. One of the things that we've always relied upon was, for example, the coastal merchant marine. We'd always relied on, up until World War II, even though our ocean-going merchant marine may decline as it does after the Civil War, we had a very robust coastal trade route, which was there. Post-World War II, that all changes. The interstate highway system, the colonial pipeline, now all of a sudden that intercoastal trade goes away. And now that disappears, and our blue water fleet is being challenged. It's globalization on an epic scale. In many ways, the maritime industry is a bellwether for where industry is going. If you look at the car industry, the aviation sector, manufacturing, all the things that those sectors are encountering already happened in the maritime industry. They're already dealing with shipping, you know, with jobs going offshore, with reflagging of corporations, with you know, outsourcing. And the question is, how do you deal with it? Now, the way the Danes, for example, look at Denmark, for example, how does a small country like Denmark have such a massive, robust merchant marine? And they do it through, you know, a couple of ways. Number one, heavily subsidize their merchant marine, especially the shipbuilding aspect. They feel that that puts a lot of people to work, and so they spend a lot of money on that. I'm not advocating that, but this is what they do. The Danes also play pretty hard ball when it comes to shipping. Maersk Company is a pretty tough customer to deal with. They're notorious, for example, out in the Pacific runs for underbidding competition, running them out, and then jacking the trade costs back up. So they can be kind of ruthless when it comes to that. But they're also, I will also say, technologically is one of those great innovators, is the Danes. You know, when they came out with the Triple E class, that's a true economy of scale vessel. I mean, 18,000 containers, that is a massive vessel with a state-of-the-art propulsion plant. You're able to operate at a new level. That is something that we consistently have been in the forefront of. And I will say again, if there is a long-term aspect we should be looking at here, is in the past, the commercial and the military sector had worked well in the maritime sector for coming up with new technical innovations, whether it be steam propulsion in the 1800s to the construction of steel and iron vessels along the Delaware River in the late 18, early 1900s, to the invention of containerization in the 1950s, the super ships, the tankers. That's something we can look at. So when we start looking at, for example, talk about new propulsion aspects, liquid natural gas or LPG, that's something that we should be embracing, because that's a potential starter that can level the playing field. It could be the clipper ship type innovation. It could be the dreadnought that radically changes and alters and levels the playing field for both military and commercial entities. So I think that's where we should be looking at times.
Eagle One?
If they know, if I push the wrong button, I can't talk. We've talked a little bit about the logistics force and the, you know, the auxiliaries, the AOs, AOEs, AKEs, which are doing good work. But one of the other missions that MSC has taken over, are they the right missions for MSC, and are there missions that they should be doing that they're not currently doing?
That's an interesting question, because one of the things that you look at right now, MSC identifies basically five missions they look at. If you look at the makeup of their fleet, they have what they call the Combat Logistics Force, which are the vessels we just talked about, and then to a lesser extent, what's called the Service Support branch, which are the fleet tugs, the ARSs, the hospital ships. They have the Special Missions Program, which is an array of different types of vessels, from ships like the Old Observation Island and the Invincible, which basically monitor rocket launches and ICBM tests, to support vessels and survey vessels. We have the Prepositioning Fleet and then the Sealift Fleet. Back in 1996, there was a big reorganization that took place post, again, the first Gulf War. There was a decision to kind of re-alter MSC under the auspices of Transportation Command. Transportation Command was stood up in 1988. It's a very interesting and strange organization, I'll tell you. Initially, Military Sealift Command was only operationally reporting to Transportation Command in times of war. Well, we hadn't declared war on a country since 1942, so there was a little bit of an issue about how that happened. That got changed, and in 1996, one of the aspects that was taken away from MSC and transferred over to SDDC, the Surface Deployment Distribution Command, was, for example, the ability of MSC to book cargo on container ships, basically to ship cargo, which was a key connection with the merchant marine that was severed and taken away from it. So I think that's an issue, for example, that should be addressed. In terms of missions, one of the things that I'm always interested in is if you look at MSC today, I think MSC needs to undergo a change. It's getting ready to move out of its headquarters in the Navy Yard over the next few years, move down to Norfolk. When it was created back in 1949, one of the things was the Army transferred over its deep water ships, its cargo ships, its tankers, its troop transports. But one of the things that the Army possessed, and they still possess to this day, are their landing craft, the LSVs, the LCUs. They even operate a missile range ship out in Kwajalein. That's an old MSC vessel. One of the interesting things that I think MSC needs to do is to look out there and see what missions it should be taking on or realigning itself. So, for example, prepositioning force, you know, you have a fleet that prepositions equipment for the Marine Corps, two brigades, one in the Indian Ocean, one in the Western Pacific. You have an Army brigade afloat. You have Air Force equipment and bombs and Navy logistics. What about the LSVs, the LCU 2000s? When we're talking about trying to marry up and do the sea basing that the MLPs are designed for, I think one of the things we have done is actually segregated out and kind of divided out elements of that. The Army has amphibious watercraft, something that the Navy has been talking about. Well, what do we do with the LCAC replacement? What do we do with the older LCU 1600s? What do we need to be doing to look at that? What about the next generation LSD? You know, should the next generation LSD be another version of the current Whidbey Island with a Navy crew, or should we do an LSD similar to what the Royal Fleet Auxiliary has that can be a civilian-manned LSD and serve as that kind of bridge between the amphibious vessels and the follow-up ships that are coming on, much like the MLP does? There was an experiment in the 1990s with the Coast Guard, seeing about getting some Coast Guard assets out of the Coast Guard. Coast Guard's now Homeland Security. And if you look at the 11 missions the Coast Guard has, one of the biggest problems the Coast Guard has is it's pulled in every direction. Does the Coast Guard need to be manning and operating buoy tenders, for example? One of the things MSC has done is special missions, special operations. You know, aids to navigation would not be a far-flung operation for MSC to take over. The NOAA fleet, the National Oceanic and Air Administration, operates an entire uniformed service fleet of survey vessels. A lot of them are previous MSC vessels that MSC no longer needs. MSC is talking about laying up one of their tag ships, the Sumner. Why not incorporate them with the NOAA fleet and relook at that issue and take a look at that? They already operate a vessel for the EPA. And so I think MSC has a potential to become more than what it is in some ways. I know its focus is DOD and obviously Navy, but as a government entity, it actually has served as a great benefit for the nation in general. I think when you look at the missions it's performed, they go across the boards. And that may be part of a long kind of look at where we need our merchant marine to go. Do we need a true U.S. merchant marine? One of the things that was created back in the Merchant Marine Act of 1936 was a provision that was added in 1938, Title 13, created something called the U.S. Maritime Service. It's actually a uniform service under the Secretary of Transportation. Do we need to kind of recreate something like that to give our merchant mariners protection or some sort of standing? Because right now they're fairly nebulous. They don't really have a lot of good standing in terms of who they are. Or, you know, if they're SIVMARs, they're government employees, but if they're contract operators, where do they kind of fall under this? And so I think that there could be a lot of discussion, and I will say that MSC has done some examinations of this. Admiral Busby, the previous commander, and now Admiral Shannon, who are, you know, Busby was a graduate of Kings Point, and Admiral Shannon's from Maine Maritime. They've been really looking at this, trying to figure out where this entity needs to go. But if you look at MSC throughout its history, it's had some commanders who have been really innovative guys who have brought a lot of ideas to it. I go back again to my study of the Vietnam War. Two of the most influential MSC commanders weren't logisticians. They were sub-commanders. Glenn Donk Donahoe and Lawson Red Ramage, they had a lot of experience with merchant marine. Their experience was sinking it during the war in the Pacific, but that gave them a very unique perspective. And I think also we're losing a key component in the Navy. One out of five vessels right now, as I said, in the battle force are manned by merchant mariners. The last master I sailed with sailed on 24 vessels. Captain, 24 different vessels. But if you look at the organization of MSC, for example, you don't take those masters off those vessels and put them into operational command within the MSC structure. And I think that's a fundamental flaw. Why is it the, you know, the vice commander of MSC or the vice, MSC commander in Atlantic or Pacific, one of these seasoned masters or engineers? And there's a lot of reasons of why that doesn't happen. You don't want to pull a master who's been sailing for 20 years and put him in that position. What you really need to do is almost come up with a track for MSC CIVMARs that will rotate them from afloat to ashore, afloat to ashore, much like you have in the Navy, and that will put them into operational guidance and actually give some of that knowledge that MSC has to the Navy. We're in a very kind of interesting situation where, you know, previous, you know, senior military Navy commanders served in AEs, they served in AFSs, they served in auxiliaries. You're going to lose that in the Navy. You're going to create an entire group of vessels that is outside the chain. You either need to reintegrate the Navy back onto those platforms or find a way to integrate MSC into that. If you look at the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, for example, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary stands up as a unique entity. Its head of it, the Commodore, is a civilian master or chief engineer. They operate as a branch of the Royal Navy. And we've done that in the past. Again, go back to the history aspect here where you had warrants and sailing masters. I think that's something MSC can basically examine. I think in the long term, that's where the command needs to go. However, unfortunately, what they tend to look at are short-term issues. The long-term tends not to be it because of the turnover, the 2-3 year turnover you have in area commands and at the main headquarters. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed.
Well, Sal, this has been a very, very fast hour, and I really appreciate you coming some time on to talk about our unsexy but important, and maybe made it a little more sexy than it would be otherwise. And if people are interested in seeing what you have, do you have some publications coming up, and what are some of the topics you're going to be investing your time in?
I do. I got an article right now in Naval History that talks about the creation of MSTS, what I call the other Admiral Callahan. It's with Naval History right now, and I hope for that to come out fairly soon. It talks about Admiral William Callahan, the commander, first commander of MSTS, who is the brother of Admiral Dan Callahan, who fought the very famous naval melee off of Guadalcanal. I'm working on a project right now, a paper I hope to have to proceedings that talks a little bit about what we talked about tonight in a little bit more detail out to them. That's my summer project in between my classwork. For long term, I'm hoping to get up with a Naval Institute Press to do a history of MSTS, MSC. I think it's something that needs to be done to really get that information out there on that, and also to finish up the draft of my revision of my doctoral dissertation, which talks about the evolution of American military sea transportation from the Spanish-American War up until the Iraq War of 2003.
Excellent. Well, good gainful employment for you, and thanks again. I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you. I appreciate, again, the opportunity to talk the topic.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Sal.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us. And please join us again next week for another live edition of MidRats, where our host, actually our guest, will be Deputy Commander for JTF HOA, Rear Admiral Krongard, and it will be earlier in the afternoon, so check your schedule. Until then, have a great Navy day. Cheers.
The same. It's a long way to Tipperary. Farewell, let us dwell. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.